This is part one of a two-part podcast. Your podcast. Episode 70 of Oscar Podcast. I'm here with Craig Kennedy and Ryan Adams and me, Sasha Stone, from awardsdaily.com. And we're going to be talking about the year 2009 when The Hurt Locker won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, Best Editing, Best Sound, and Best Sound Editing. And its biggest challenger was Avatar. Before we get to that, we're going to continue talking about the wonderful Ari Folman film we just saw called The Congress, which is actually on Time Warner VOD right now. You can watch it before it hits theaters August 29th, I think it is. It has a release date. It's fascinating. Robin Wright basically is the producer of this movie, and she kind of helped to create this part for herself. Obviously, because there are no parts like this, especially in fanboy, promoted science fiction or big budget Hollywood films. And the movie kind of toys with that idea, of course. It actually doesn't toy with it. It dives right into it. She's an actress who's over the hill. She's Robin Wright, actually, who made all these terrible choices. And they want her back as Buttercup and Jenny from Forrest Gump, and so they digitize her to kind of live in this new...
So they can go back to the way that where the studio people thought she was at her peak. They want to always have her at that stage where she never goes beyond that, and so that no one else ever sees her in anything beyond that.
Right. We also have to talk about Boyhood, because I've had several requests from you listeners that we talk about Boyhood since we cheated you out of it last time. We said we were going to talk about it, and then we didn't. I never heard the end of it. So we will definitely talk about Boyhood, I promise. Ryan hasn't seen it, but Craig and I have, and so we'll spend a good deal of time on that and its Oscar prospects before moving on to 2009. The Congress, do you think that it has a chance in any category, maybe animated?
I think that it probably stands a good chance in animated, although it's at least half live action, so I'm not sure what the qualifications are, whether they take a stopwatch and measure how much is animated and how much is not. I can't offhand think of any precedent where there are combination live action and animated films to that extent that were ever nominated for animated, but it seems more likely to be an animated nominee than a live action nominee.
Well, the only one I can think of that kind of comes close, even though it doesn't come close at all, was the phenomenon that was Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but that was out before they had an animated category.
Yeah, that was also a mixture of the live action and animated were on screen at the same time. So yeah. That's a little bit different, because there was always something animated happening on screen just about.
Right. So it would only really have an opportunity to get a Best Picture nomination, which it will not get. It's too bad it wouldn't be a strong contender for Best Actress. You know, she's great in it.
It is too bad. I think that I think if more people would see it and think about what they saw, and I think it's the kind of movie that you need to see twice, because even though I didn't fully understand it the first time I saw it, I understood enough of it to know that it was all going to fit, that when I saw it again a second and third time, that it would logically hold together, which a lot of times when you see a movie that doesn't seem like it, you can't really get a handle on it the first time, you realize it's because it's not very well constructed or whatever. But this movie, I think, is really airtight in its construction, and it does hold up on second and third viewing, and it improves so much more because you see where it's going. I think that maybe for that reason, I would say that I wish that it had a chance at the Best Adapted Screenplay nomination.
Right, right. But of course it won't, because that's usually where all the best picture heat is. So
Also, because it veers so much from the source material. I mean, the Stanislaw Lem novel doesn't have anything to do with movies at all. It really, the first half of the movie, The Congress, has nothing at all to do with the book that it was based on. It's only when it gets into the animated section of the movie that it starts to have any connection to the original source material at all.
The way he's talked about it in interviews, he wasn't necessarily adapting the Lem story, but it was more of an inspiration for the animated portion of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've also heard, back to the point that Robin Wright is a producer of the movie, I've heard that he started working on the movie before he had in mind who he wanted to star in it, and he met Robin Wright at a function of some sort and knew that she was perfect for it and told her about the movie before he even had it written, and he thought that they might work on it together, but it turns out that they didn't. So what he ended up doing, he completed the script and sent it to her, and she just wrote back, whatever you want me to do, I'm on board, totally on board, 100%. And she was really happy with what he gave her. And that she also feels like, he always felt like that he was writing the Robin Wright character to be her, but he found out later that her personal opinion was that the only thing that she gave to the movie was her name and the fact of the two movies that you mentioned that she was in, Princess Bride and Forrest Gump. Those are the only two things from her own life that she felt like that she loaned to the movie. Otherwise, she doesn't personally see any relationship between herself and the character.
I looked up her filmography, and it is sort of what people thought about her. It was that she had a really promising career. Then she married Sean Penn, had a bunch of kids, did kind of the Annette Bening thing of sort of disappearing out of sight and then showing up later to try to have a career again. As an older actress in Hollywood, which is 10 times harder to do. But you know what? It actually isn't true. She's been making movies all along. They just haven't been good movies. Some of them have been mediocre, and some of them just downright awful. Some of them really good attempts that just never had any traction. So it's not that she hasn't been working. It's that she hasn't been in any kind of movie that got, like, buzz and hype. And
Right. And it's not even that she didn't make any movies that weren't any good. It's just the movies that were good didn't get the attention that they deserved. And it's interesting, too, that really she's at the peak of her career right now. I think her career is better right now than it's ever been in her entire life. So it's a little bit of a disconnect between the reality about her actual career and what was happening in the movie as far as that goes.
And one of the reasons why, I think, is that she hasn't monked her face. You know, it's like, the last actress I saw did something weird to their face was Joan Allen on The Killing. It's like, she did some weird shit to her face. It's like, why do they do that? I don't understand. They're so beautiful, and it's so obvious that they've done work. And yet I think of Helen Hunt in the Oscar race, who hadn't had her face touched at all, and people making comments about how she looked like a grandma standing next to all the other actresses who were her age, who obviously did have work done. So,
and I think there's a line in the Congress about that. I think that when they flash forward to 20 or 25 years later in the future, they realize that there's a value, too, in having an actress who hasn't done any work on her face, because it's the real pure older person face that is so almost inconceivable in the future that you could find anybody like that. And so they treasure her for that.
Yeah, and she's finding roles that fit her age. You know, I mean, it's hard to do, obviously. I mean, a lot of actresses, I'm sure, would want to be. Patricia Arquette is another one, as we move into Boyhood, who has done nothing to her face. And she's kind of sinking into who she is as a human being, right? And also not being the actress, like, for instance, the reverse of that is Nicole Kidman, who is fighting the age tooth and nail, who wants to still play those young female parts. She doesn't want to give it over and be the older actress. She doesn't want that. That is the last thing she wants. So she's fighting it. But actresses like Robin Wright and Patricia Arquette are sinking into following Meryl Streep's trajectory and playing, you know, characters who aren't attractive necessarily or don't have to be like the love interest, but can play the bitchy wife of Kevin Spacey, you know, as Robin Wright does.
Although, let's not say that she's not attractive, because she's hot. She's still just as hot now as she ever was, I think, even hotter.
Ryan, let Craig talk, because we're...
Can we just stipulate that people suck? On one hand, we laugh at Helen Hunt, who has the nerve to get naked when she's old. And then on the other hand, we laugh at Kim Novak, who's gone to great lengths to try and continue to look young. It's like, you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. And it's just ridiculous.
That's so true.
I just wanted to point that out.
Yes, thank you. Good. Hear, hear. I'll drink to that.
And also, in Nicole Kidman's defense, although there did seem like there was a time when she was going down the road where she was trying to hold on too tightly to her youth, I think that she either listened to the criticism or she saw herself what was happening, and she has stopped doing that, I think.
Yeah.
I think that she got off of that path and decided to grow older gracefully.
Yeah, if possible. I mean, she's done permanent changes to her face. Like, her lips are bigger than, and they'll never go back to the way they were. I just think that, like Craig is saying, like, it isn't fair that we punish women for doing it and we punish women for not doing it. You know, I think that our culture, you know, hates women. Just women hate women and men hate women. I mean, you only have to go to a certain website to see how deep that hatred goes. It's repulsive and repugnant that it exists, but it exists, and a lot of it is on women. A lot of it is women hating on women. I'm sad to have to say it, but it's true. And
hating on themselves.
And a milder term for hate would maybe just be resentment. I think especially resentment against or toward actresses who have so much going for them to begin with that it's like you'd love to hate them, but it's more of a resentment thing than it is hate. Because I don't know who hates Nicole Kidman.
Oh, a lot of people do. I mean, if you read the internet, it can really get you down. if you stay away from the internet, you're never going to come, like, face to face with the sphincter of humanity, which right. lets out a giant fart right in your face. It's like, oh, thanks, internet. I love you too. But, you know, you don't have to see the world that way. But yes, if you do, you will see. And if you walk into supermarkets and you see the tabloids, those aren't for men, those are for women. And women read those, and they're disgusting. Every day there's some other horrible thing. Gwyneth Paltrow, homewrecker, you know, Kim Kardashian, cottage cheese thighs. You know, it's just constant and never stops. And if I could just do one thing, it's just make women try. I try every day. It's a struggle for me not to say something catty and mean on Twitter about somebody.
Anybody can say anything they want to say about Kim Kardashian, and it's not going to bother me very much. Because,
well,
I mean, I don't even
her,
know why anybody wants to talk about her in the first place.
But not just her, but anybody. Like, any old person that's a woman, people love to be catty about them. You know, some men get it, too. James Franco is one who does. Shia LaBeouf is another, Justin Bieber, you know, there are just people that we like to dump on a daily basis. But basically, back to the whole plastic surgery thing is just, I commend women like Robin Wright and Patricia Arquette for, you know, finding that groove, finding a way to live with yourself, have your own life, and be able to look at yourself in the mirror, and to find parts that tell stories about women like that. Like, we don't need women, you know, trying to make themselves look younger so that they can play parts for women that are younger. Like, can't the women who are older play parts of women who are older? Can't we tell those stories? Can't those stories? They are in the UK. They are in every other country. If you go to Cannes, you'll see movies like about women in their 60s who write poetry from Korea, you know, or 70s even. It's like you see that spectrum. Women are treated like people. Here they're treated like objects, you know, the young, pretty object. And once they pass that, they're done. And that's the beautiful thing about the Congress is it peels back the skin and exposes that part of Hollywood that is so repulsive.
So I'm sure when Ari Folman first approached Robin Wright with this idea that she was so grateful and so glad to find a role like this, because it's not as if she does manage to land roles in movies that are age appropriate for her, but they're really small roles, like in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and what else has she been in? Like Moneyball, where she's just almost like a cameo, right?
Right.
But so she does find those roles, but they're small roles. They're not lead roles. And so she must have been so grateful to find a director who was willing to treasure her for what she has to offer.
Yeah.
And that's the same. And I think we should applaud those directors. And David Fincher is one of them who can spot an actress like that and realize that he can write a plum role for her or create something like House of Cards, where an actress like that can really find something to sink her teeth into.
Absolutely.
She's lucky, too, because he originally intended Cate Blanchett for the role. That's originally who he had in the mind when he started writing it, but he happened to meet Robin Wright before he met Cate Blanchett. It was just a kind of a random occurrence, and he decided right then and there that she was the one. But that points up another problem, is that there's just there aren't enough of these parts to go around. There's like a block of reasonably successful over 40 women, but there aren't enough roles for them.
And it's a double-edged sword because I was watching the movie thinking, this is so incredible that that she's in this part and that this movie is about her and it's about this older woman. And the idea of it is she's an actress and she really just wants to be with her son, and this idea of the fantasy life versus real life. And he animates her showing her face as it is. He doesn't animate her, you know, as a younger, beautiful version of herself. She looks like an older woman. And that reminded me of Miyazaki, by the way, sidebar. But I was watching it thinking, if this movie starred somebody like Jennifer Lawrence or Cate Blanchett or someone like that, it would get a whole different response from the critics, I'm telling you, and the bloggers. They would pay so much more attention to it because Robin Wright has been put into that category of she's not hot, she's not sexy, she's not somebody people are talking about, you know. And so I find that the Congress isn't getting the kind of generated heat that I think it should. And I'm going to have to try to change that a little bit. But Eric Cohn on IndieWire wrote the best, I think, review and the only review that got a score of 100. He seems to be a little more open-minded than a lot of the critics today, especially where women are concerned. But I just like, really, you know, really, critics?
It's like, well, also, too, it just came out. I mean, people are just now having a chance to see it. People in Europe were able to see it several months ago, but only in America has people even had access to this movie.
I know, but no buzz, no talk, nothing. Just right. Flatline. Mm-hmm.
Well, Ari Folman's difficult. You know, it's not as if Waltz with the Bashir was exactly an easy movie to get your head around. It was a difficult watch, you know.
That's why I'm saying, if it was Jennifer Lawrence in that part, people would be looking at the same exact movie with Jennifer Lawrence. It would be heralded as the second coming of Christ, practically. Like, people would just be talking about it. And that's the thing I think is sad and frustrating, because here's a really important topic, you know, an aging actress in Hollywood on being the lead in a film. I mean, you know how rare that is? Not rare for the 1950s and going backwards, but rare for today's times, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think even in the 1950s, with something like Sunset Boulevard, it was a shock for people to see that represented so boldly, so harshly, really, in those terms. I mean, it's really been pretty rare throughout Hollywood history that any time that Hollywood has turned inward to look at itself like that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that Folman really intentionally set out to do a scathing look at Hollywood, but he just found that was a better handle for him to get into the themes of the novel than the novel was, which had more to do with politics and communism.
That's what he said in an interview. Yeah, I read that. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter, because it just so happens that his version of it does skewer Hollywood hardcore.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's about communism or whatever, but it's also, it is beautifully about not just Hollywood, really. Like, you can't even say it's Hollywood. It's our culture. It's the internet. It's fandom. It's avatar life, you know, like we're living now, which is we want this other dimension, this Facebook reality of, well, look at us, selfie.
Right.
You know?
It diminishes the movie to say that it's only about Hollywood, because you're so right. It's about the culture. It's about the culture in general, about wanting to identify with something that is so transient. Yeah. And unattainable for people, but they still want to be on team this or team that.
Yes, I know, I have a feeling that the Congress, although who knows how things work anymore. I can just say what would have worked back when I was young, but I don't know nowadays. I really don't. But I would think that this is a movie that's going to be around for a while. People are going to keep talking about and seeing and.
It feels like I want it to be more than a cult film, but I think it will be at least a cult film. I think it will be the kind of movie that people become more and more attached to as time goes on, and it will have its group of acolytes that honor and respect it and understand it and appreciate it.
Yeah.
I think that it may be a little difficult for a huge mass mainstream audience, though.
Yeah, no, I know that. I'm not even talking about them. I'm talking about the stupid asshole bloggers who should be talking about this movie, and they aren't, you know?
That's what
makes me mad, is that if it was Jennifer Lawrence or any other kind of quote-unquote hot star, they would be talking about it. It's just that it happens to be somebody that isn't sexy to them, you know, and isn't interesting. So they don't talk about it and just kind of fades away. So it's surprising to me. I kept wondering, why aren't people... I, when I heard the total, you know, echoing of nothingness around the Congress, I thought, boy, that movie must really suck because no one is saying a goddamn thing about it. I looked up the reviews. Eric Kahn had one good review from back in March when I played in Cannes. And I watched it and I was like, wow. And by the end, it totally gutted me. Like, it just was one of those movies that I haven't seen many of them in my life. But by the end, it just like, oh, it was like a punch in the stomach. I just started crying.
We talked about it in an email last night when you were halfway through it, and you said that you really liked it so far, but you were just getting into it and wondered how it was going to turn out. And I actually had misgivings. I was afraid that it might lose you halfway through, especially when it got to be so outlandishly animated and so extravagantly absurdist almost. I thought that you might, because it's, second half is so different from the first half, and I thought that you were so much enjoying the first half that you might be disappointed. So I'm really glad to find out that it held on, that it held on to your emotions all the way through.
Well, remember, my daughter is 16, and she's like an animated geek, like... So animation is always in our household, you know, it's always... In fact, she was watching it at the same time as I was, you know, she...
Oh, fantastic.
I was
a little bit... I won't even say. There's something about her family unit that seems like one of her children is given more prominence than the other child, and that bothered me just a little bit. But by the end of the movie, they had explained that away. They explained it well enough so that I could accept it.
Yeah, no, but I hear you on that. Yeah, it does. I mean, it is the kind of movie, like a lot of movies, like 2001, like The Shining, you know, where there are things about it that if you sit down, just like that article, Ryan, that the flawed and overrated piece that you and I just both wrote and put up on Words Daily, you know, there are always going to be things in a movie that aren't exactly perfect or sometimes don't add up. I don't know, but it doesn't really matter if the overall thing is great, you know. Mm-hmm. Over time, you forgive that stuff. You know, you just don't think about it anymore. But when you're in...
I will say, too, you know what, about the Congress and Cannes, the Congress was at Cannes in 2013. It was a full year ago that it was at Cannes.
I actually wanted off to go see it, but because it was director's fortnight instead of the main Cannes program, I ended up getting lost on the way to the hotel to where it was screening, and I never, ever saw it.
So it wasn't this year, it was the year before?
It was last year at Cannes, yeah. So that's why it seems like that the talk about it has died down so much, because it's been a full 18 months practically since it first was seen.
Oh, so it wasn't this last year?
No, it was May 2013 is when the reviews came out, the first reviews, yeah. And so then it knocked around in Europe for a while, and a lot of people in Europe have seen it, but I don't think Americans have really had a chance to see it until just this past week or so. So I'm still hoping that the quietness that we're seeing is just because that people haven't caught up with it yet.
Wow, I can't believe that it was that long ago.
Yeah.
So now I see what you mean, Craig, about eligibility. I was thinking it was just this past year it was in Cannes. How come it took so long for it to get a release date?
I don't know about that, unless it's just because distributors were wary of it and felt uncertain about its marketability. That's the only thing I can think of.
Because it's got a tiny distributor, Draft House Films. They didn't pick it up until probably late in the process. So they're probably not even thinking about Oscars. They're just thinking about how can we make the most money that we can out of this thing.
Yeah, no, you're right. They're not thinking about Oscars, probably because they don't know where they could put the Oscars. You know, like
it's an awkward fit. I think Oscars a little too stuck up its own ass to really stop and consider what it is. I mean, I think as I was watching it at first, I thought, you know, this has a real shot because the first half is so strong that the actors are going to get on board. But then 45 minutes in, it clicks to animated, and I think that's going to turn a lot of the actors off. If they could have held the actors somehow, then I think it would have had a shot. But
I think really too, tough. I think too, the fact that the first half of the movie is really straightforward and easy to grasp on the first viewing, but the second half of the movie, I really think that I didn't even really get it until the second time I saw it. And when it comes to Oscar voters and Academy members watching movies on screeners, if a movie doesn't get them the first time around, they're not going to have time or inclination to give it another chance enough to figure out what it's all about. I think that's what hurt Inside Llewyn Davis. Inside Llewyn Davis, I think, is a movie that you have to see twice before you really figure out what it's all about. And if you don't give a movie, if you just look at a movie on its face value after first viewing and it doesn't come together for you, then it's not going to stick when you're filling out your ballots.
Yeah. I could go on and on about Llewyn Davis, but let's switch to Boyhood so we don't cheat out our readers who are dying to hear us talk about Boyhood. Okay, here we go. You ready?
I'm ready to listen. I haven't had an opportunity to see it yet, but I'll try to play dumb guy and ask some dumb questions.
Well, Craig and I have seen it, so we can talk.
Yeah, right. I'll listen to you, too.
Yeah, there you go. And we can talk about it, and without spoilers, hopefully. I guess since people have probably already read all the reviews, it has a perfect score of 100 on Metacritic, which is rare, and I've never really seen it with a new movie. It's always with classics and not with new movies, although the abortion movie... whatever it is, that came really close to a score of 100. But part of the thing you have to understand with that is that the face of critics have changed over the years, and especially now. Like, for instance, Kenneth Turan didn't like Boyhood, but his review isn't on there because he chose not to review it because he didn't want to shit all over it before it had a chance to open, which is admirable of him. So they had another reviewer put it in, so she gave it a positive review. So with Kenneth Turan's review, it would have dropped it down to maybe 98, which is still really high. But, of course, because it has such a high score, it's starting to induce all these, like, weird navel-gazing think pieces about, whether it's good enough, whether it deserves the praise, whether it's good for film, good for movies, if they praise it so high, and all these dumb things. And we're not even in Oscar season yet, so I don't know what's going to happen to the movie when Oscar season starts.
Seems like the backlash is dying down a little bit to me. It flared up there for a little while when it first started playing in theaters, but it's kind of going away again. I think calmer heads are prevailing and people are seeing that it is really good.
Yeah, or like, because I've had two personal friends of mine on Facebook go see it, not in our weird scene at all, but not liking it and thinking, I can't believe people thought this was a good movie. It's so boring. It's like watching paint dry. I think that with Boyhood, it really matters who you are, how you grew up, whether you have a kid or not, whether you relate to the lead character or not. All of those things are going to matter. And I think it's one of those movies that if it doesn't grab you, you're going to find it, you're not going to understand why people love it the way that they do.
Well, it's funny. It's not the kind of movie where you can sit there and pick it apart scene by scene or action by action, because there's some stuff that happens in it, and actually a lot of it I just kind of filtered out of my head. Like, it bothered me that the evil stepfather thing kind of got on my nerves after a while, but I completely forgot about that until somebody mentioned it to me. And it's like, yeah, if you go along, there's like individual little moments that maybe work or they maybe don't, but you can't really judge this movie on its individual little moments. You have to take it as a whole and sort of think about the impact that it has on you, thinking about the whole thing. That doesn't make any sense at all, but that's sort of the beauty of this film, is the way that it captures 12 years of a life at a time of life that changes so rapidly. And to nitpick it is not... You're not trying hard enough. You need to look at the whole before you can start picking apart the little details.
Yeah, and I mean, if you grew up in a certain generation where you were older, like much older than the kid in the movie, like Kenneth Turan, for instance, and Kenneth Turan, I believe, has never had kids. So I think that for him, he's kind of looking at that kid going, I don't relate to him at all. I don't really like Richard Linklater movies, as he admitted. He'd seen the before movies and he didn't like them. So he's just not on that wavelength at all. I think he can still look at it from cinema perspective and say, that's a good movie. But the truth is if you don't like Richard Linklater's style, which is he really likes people talking. He likes people talking about ideas. He likes ideas... being discussed and bounced off of each person and seeing what they think of that, different perspectives. But he's an idea guy. He's a conversation guy. He's a he's not a, you know, a visual cinema guy. He's not a Kubrick. He's not a Scorsese. He's not a Tarantino, you know. But he's about, his movies are about relationships and thoughtful examination of life. And I happen to respond really well to that. So I loved watching this kid grow up. I loved hearing him talk. I loved how he grew up and who he became. It took my breath away watching him. I just was like, wow. I mean, it helps that I have a daughter who's 16 and the kid grows to be 18. And it was like a dagger in my heart watching that. You know, it happened too fast. Don't keep growing. Stop growing, you know.
Goodbye, yard. Goodbye, crepe myrtle. Goodbye, mailbox. Goodbye, box of stuff Mommy won't let us take with us, but we don't want to throw away. Goodbye, house. I'll never like Mommy as much for making us move.
Samantha, why don't you say goodbye to that little horse shit attitude, okay? Because we're not taking that in the cart.
Goodbye, old lady. Listen to rock music and ride the motorcycle.
Turan is older than me, but I'm probably closer to him in worldview than I am to you, because I'm not a parent, and I am a man, and I don't particularly like the Before movies either, taken individually, but this movie is so much better than those. It does in one movie what that movie takes three movies to do, and you're right, it is conversational. There is a lot of talking, but having it broken up over the course of the 12 years makes it different, because you just get this overwhelming sense of the passage of time and the fact that time moves, at least in our culture, in one direction and you can't ever go back. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to you about it afterwards, about how, you know, you're watching scenes with this kid and then it'll jump forward and your brain is like, wait a minute, no, I'm not ready to go to this moment in time yet. I want to stay where he is in this moment. I'm not done with this yet. But that's not the way time works, and I've never seen a movie that captured that sense. And it's been interesting, because for the last couple of months I started doing Throwback Thursdays on Facebook, and I've had pictures of myself laying around for a long time, but I've never looked at them, because as I've gotten older I haven't been comfortable with the passage of time. But now suddenly looking at pictures of myself when I was 2 and 3 and pictures when I was awkward 12 and 11 and and seeing how I look now compared to that, with the extra 50 pounds and the gray hair, I feel better about it, because it's like I realize that it's all a part of this continuum, and I'm really the same person that I was in those pictures from 20 years ago. I'm different in that I've grown and I've changed, but I'm still that person, and there's just something Boyhood captured that exact same feeling in a way that unlike any other movie that I've ever seen.
Same here, and that leads me to this whole idea of people using this dumb buzzword that it's a gimmick, and I know a lot of people have criticized it for that, but here's the thing. Most of the time, movies are looking backwards in time through the prism of present day. So they're going, cherry-picking out what they think was important of that time and memorable of that time. But the difference between Boyhood and movies that flash back is that Boyhood is going through that, going through Obama, going through Iraq, you know, and it's happening at that time. So they didn't have the luxury. I think you're talking about Star Wars at one point in the movie, and they're saying, oh, they're never going to have another Star Wars movie or something. But
that would be terrible.
That's something you wouldn't necessarily plant back in there. You might, but you might color it differently. So he was smart to bring in cultural references as the movie goes forward in, I thought, a very clever way. Especially since they kind of divide themselves up into he becomes more Christian and she becomes a college professor. Watching them grow is a universal experience, like you say, with all of us. That is the one thing we know, is time marches forward. We age, we die. You know, that's it. And I've never seen a movie really grab that. I've never experienced what I experienced watching Boyhood, because it was like watching my daughter.
Not in the same way.
Because for one thing, the movie doesn't allow itself, by the way that it was filmed, it can't possibly allow itself the benefit of hindsight. You can't write about 12 years ago, not knowing what it's going to be like 12 years in the future. You're writing about and portraying what's happening in the moment, and not knowing what's going to happen over the next 12 years. And so that's how it's different from a flashback. With a flashback, you know how to make all the pieces fit. But with the structure of Boyhood, there's no way to know how all the pieces are going to fit until you see the entire puzzle come together.
Well, except there is some
hindsight benefit with the editing. We don't know what was left on the editing room floor, right. And the choices that they made on what to leave in, what to take out were informed by the here and now, but still, you're right. It's those things happened when they happened, and they happened the way they happened, and there's no changing that.
I know. And I
can I ask you to go ahead, Cortaja? I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that, like, for instance, if you compare it with Michael Apted's Up series, you know, where it really didn't probably leave much on the cutting room floor, and that really does sort of capture that moment in time. And Richard Linklater's film is clearly not a documentary. It's a narrative. It is very much in control of his idea. You know, like he has command of the story and the script and the characters. He knows where he wants it to go. He may have edited it in order to highlight those moments that are still valid and important today, you know. But the thing that I love so much about the movie is that the characters are not perfect. Like, he's kind of annoying at some points, the kid, you know. And, you know, he's difficult, and he's not easy for the girl that he's with to get along with, for instance. He's a little morbid, you know, which I also appreciate and love. But and Patricia Arquette is far from perfect. That's why perhaps I have my own experiences with abusive men. I've been drawn to them, and I know what it's like to want a father for your child. I know what it's like to go from living in a shitty apartment to going and living in a really nice house, you know, with a kitchen and bedrooms and laundry room and a big car. And you suddenly feel normal, and you feel like you're giving your kid what every family wants. And then the guy turns out to be a fucking jerk, and you have to pack everything up and leave. And then you have to deal with the mistakes and sift through the rubble of wreckage of your life, you know. And we want to be perfect, and we want to think that we don't make those mistakes again. But you know what? We almost always do, inevitably. That was so true about this movie, was that she had a type, the poor woman. She had a type. We all have types, you know.
Don't we all, right?
And they're not always people who are the best choices, you know.
I was going to ask you.
I'm glad that you brought the Up movies into it, because there was a noted critic, who I'm not even going to name by giving him credit, that used those as a criticism against Boyhood, as it being something that's already been done before and done better. And it's a totally different thing, because as the Up movies have been made, I mean, it's different now if you've just discovered them and you go back and you binge watch all of them. But most people haven't done that. You've been watching them every 7 years as they come out, and that experience, you growing along with those kids, is very different than seeing one kid's life distilled into 3 hours. It's a totally, totally different thing. Mm. And to use that as an excuse for Boyhood not being the coming of movie Jesus is just ridiculous.
Well, also, too, it's just they're just different on a basic level. Boyhood is fiction. It's not, they're not filming the actual life of what really happened to this kid, and what really happened to Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette as they were growing older. They're all fictional characters. The only thing that's reality that's not fictional about it is the fact that they were all aging in time over the period of 12 years. The Up series was cinema verite. It was a documentary. There's no doubt about the fact that Up is a documentary, and Boyhood is not a documentary. And so they're just totally different on that level, right? It's infuriating to think that people would compare them and say that, try to you know, pretend like they're related in that way.
Right, because no one's ever done that in a narrative fact. Like, anything could have happened. Somebody could have died. You know, I mean, there's so many different variables that where it could have gone wrong.
It's true that there is a gimmicky quality to Boyhood, and I went into it sort of with my arms crossed, thinking, okay, this is just a gimmick. But it's a gimmick that works, for one thing, and here's a newsflash for everybody. Every movie is a gimmick. They're all artificial. They all take reality and do their own thing with it, and they're all constructed in a certain way, and this is just its particular way of doing it, and it happens to be unique in terms of other movies that I've seen.
Tell me, speaking of the gimmick,
what's that?
Go ahead.
And I was going to add that the same critic used the Antoine Doinel character from the 400 Blows movie that the filmmaker kept coming back to. That's another completely different thing because, again, it's over the series of several movies, and it's just a totally unique thing to have it all happen in one movie. I keep making that same point, but it's important.
No, the Antoine Doinel movies are each self-contained within their own two-hour span of time, and they each tell a self-contained plot that has a beginning, middle, and end. The fact that they're related by having the same character is no different from the Die Hard movies being related by having the same character.
You know, Die I mean, Hard not that, not
right. But that's just another bad comparison right there. But I mean, talk about gimmicks. Citizen Kane was the ultimate gimmick, and the Rashomon was a gimmick.
Totally. Citizen Kane, and people probably came at Citizen Kane in a very similar way. People are just weird. Like, they don't... Okay, so The Artist was a total gimmick, wasn't it? It was a...
Right, yeah.
So, you know...
Memento was a gimmick. Pulp Fiction was a gimmick. Mm. And all of those movies actually were criticized for being gimmicks.
And what
all
about Inglourious Bastards?
Can bite it. It's called making movies, boys and girls.
Every Tarantino movie is a gimmick. Every one. Mm-hmm. Every
it's the same
one.
Gimmick over and over.
Well, the people who get really snotty about it, especially a movie like Pulp Fiction, they're like, would it be as good of a movie if you told it in order? And it's not. But that they use that as an example of why it's not a good movie. And I don't subscribe to that particular brand of broken logic, but that's what those people would argue, that a good movie should be a good movie in the proper order.
That's just nonsense. I'm sorry, but he filmed a fucking movie over a 12-year period. I'd like to see any one of these dumb little assholes do that, or even attempt to do that, or even think of doing that, or having that kind of dedication to making a movie like that, to capture someone growing up on film like that, in a narrative. Yes, Michael Apted did it. He did it. He's done it. And what, they're like 50 now, the Up kids that started at 7 or something, you know. So, yeah, he did it. But I'm sorry, but I watched all those Up movies, and not a single one of them had the same emotional impact as Boyhood, as 3 hours of Boyhood, because Boyhood is a film. It's a film. It tells a story. And I can't tell you for sure or not if they used actors to show the age, if it would have the same impact. I don't know if it would. I don't know, because a lot of the magic of that movie is watching that kid grow up into who he becomes when he grows up. And you know what? Richard Linklater got lucky, because he picked an actor who grew up to be a really cool kid, you know?
Yeah.
And it wouldn't have worked if he hadn't. Who knows? I mean, there's so many different ways it could have gone. Now, Richard Linklater, like Cameron Crowe, and Frank Capra, and much of Billy Wilder's work, you know, he's an optimist. You know, he sees the best in human beings, and his films all illustrate that. And they're beautiful things. They're beautiful experiences. That is Richard Linklater's world. And if you're not down with that, if you're a depressive person and you really want to see a tragedy unfold, you're not going to take to Boyhood. If you want to see someone die in a car accident, or someone get raped, or someone get murdered, you know, and the family living around that, like in the bedroom or something, you know, if you have a bleak, dark view of the world and that's what you want to see in all the movies that you like, you know, Boyhood is whimsical. It's a whimsical, lovely Valentine to life and to youth, you know.
It's like watching paint dry.
I was curious. I haven't read any reviews at all, and I don't intend to until after I see the movie. But I'm wondering, so the movie's 3 hours long, and it covers 12 years. That's roughly, if you divide it out, it would be about 15 minutes per year. Does the movie kind of follow along with that pattern, or are some years given more precedence than other years, just out of curiosity?
I don't even remember if they covered every year or if it just kind of jumped.
Oh, is that right? Because I thought they got together every 12 years and filmed another week or 2 weeks of filming, and then so I figured that there was at least a year. Every year was given some sort of coverage.
They did. I just don't know how much he kept it, how much he edited and kept. But according to Patricia Arquette, who I interviewed, they definitely did get together every year mm-hmm. to film. You know, and she was like, all these things were going on in our lives. You know, I was doing Medium the whole time. I was making that movie. I was doing Medium. So she really grew as an actress. She changed very dramatically from who she was at the beginning to who she is at the end. And part of that is her acting experience, and part of that is just growing up and growing old. And
I can't imagine. I don't even want to try to imagine. I don't want you to tell me either how the transitions between years are covered, how they make the swap from year to year. But I can imagine that it's really heartbreaking to see those transitions, the pages flip of the photo album, to see those flip by.
I mean, it's especially hard if you're a parent, I have to say.
Noticeable with the little kid, because obviously he's changed the most, but it was fascinating to watch Patricia Arquette change too. I mean, her styles would change obviously, but also she progressively got older, and sometimes she weighed a little more than other times. And it was just a very real, organic way of treating the passage of time that you don't normally get in a movie that's been scripted and production designed to within an inch of its life to simulate something. This had a gravity of realness to it.
And she and I were talking about the stuff going on behind the scenes, and I was telling her how a movie about the making of Boyhood would be a good movie. Like that reminds me kind of like something Truffaut might do, or Godard, where the movie is going on, and in the background you're actually watching them live their lives, and then they get together every 12 years to meet and to make this thing. And he, you know, a lot of things, like he got divorced from Uma Thurman, Ethan Hawke, you know, during this time. He met somebody else. He had a new baby. You know, a lot of life changes in their lives were happening, you know, divorces, marriages, you know, various things.
So there's a meta thing going on. Even the people who are aware of that sort of thing will think about that as seeing the movie, but you don't necessarily have to think about it in order to get a lot out of the movie.
And on
the same topic, I will say that I hope, and I don't really believe that I know that being a parent and seeing the movie is different experience than not being a parent and seeing the movie, but I really hope and don't expect that it's necessary to be a parent in order to enjoy the movie, right? Because anybody should be able to feel empathy.
It wasn't for me. I think it's the kind of movie that anybody of a certain openness of mind can bring their own thing to it, and they can see themselves in it if they look hard enough.
And probably the reason is that even if we're not parents, we've all been a child. We've all been a child, and we've all had a mother, and we've all grown up in a family, and so that's all right. That's covered by the movie really well. We've all had a boyhood or a girlhood.
But it helps if you had a boyhood and a girlhood similar to his, like, for instance, I did. I had a strong single mom like that, you know, growing up, and she wasn't as together as Patricia Arquette in the movie, but it was sort of the same old deal. And this is, you know, he's my age, so a lot of the stuff, you know, a lot of those experiences rang very true to me. I would imagine Kenneth Turan being 20 years older than me, you know, maybe that isn't his boyhood. Maybe his boyhood is more like the 1950s kind of boyhood, you know?
Right, because he was born in 1946. Yeah, he's close to 7 years old.
I'm still not buying Kenneth Turan's response to it, because my boyhood was nothing like that kid's, and I still totally identified with it.
Because
I'm older now, it was a mixture of his experience, and it was a mixture of Patricia Arquette's experience. Even though I'm not a parent, I still know what it's like to be an adult and to make adult mistakes. So it was a combination of the two. I don't think it needs to be a mirror reflection of your life in order to like this movie.
And I'm going to be the guy who stands up for Kenneth Turan. I'm really am proud of the fact that he admitted that Richard Linklater movies are just not his thing. A lot of critics will continually review movies by directors that we know they don't like. I'm thinking of Rex Reed and Christopher Nolan. Rex Reed has never even understood what's going on in a Christopher Nolan movie, much less be able to adequately, you know, be able to review it. He admits straight up front he doesn't know what's going on. So don't write about it, dude, you know. But so for Kenneth Turan to sort of recuse himself from reviewing the movie by saying, really not my cup of tea, I don't think that we need to isolate it and think it's only because he's not from the same generation. I think he specifically does not care for this, whatever it is about Richard Linklater that is maybe too avant-garde for him or whatever. It doesn't have anything to do with identifying with the characters.
Yeah.
One thing that was interesting for me...
Thanks for saying yeah. So I didn't know if I would.
I'm sorry, I just didn't have anything to add to what you were saying.
I'm
not trying to be critical of Kenneth Turan. I just happen to disagree with him. But it's interesting to me that my experience, like I said before, seems to be more in tune with his. So I'm just sort of not... I'm not buying the idea that it's an unrelatable kind of film. But what one other thing that was interesting about it was seeing it with Sasha and Sasha's daughter, and to hear us all talking about it afterwards, is we're all different people in different stages of life in a certain way, but we all liked it in our own way, and we all sort of took our own thing from it. And I think that's a lot of what's happening to the people who are responding to it so strongly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my daughter didn't really react to it. Like, it didn't.
She did. She liked it, though. She didn't swoon over it the way you and I did. But there's still a lot of it that she liked, and she will probably feel different if she watches it again in 20 years. But
she wanted it to be more about the girl. I think that's really the
right.
She wanted it to be about the sister because she really liked her, and she did not feel that the movie was enough about her.
I wonder how much of the sister is on the cutting room floor. I would like to see more about her as well in an extended 6-hour DVD.
Someone has even said maybe that we'll get a sisterhood movie. I mean a girlhood movie. You know, it uses the footage that they may have filmed that involved the girl, the daughter.
Well, it's also very much his life. It's very much telling right. Richard Linklater's childhood. And That's the key here. I mean, that we really are talking about a portrait of an artist. This is his life, his story. And the other thing is that that's his real daughter. That's Richard Linklater's real daughter. So I don't know how comfortable he would feel with certain narratives with her, the way that you have to get
into. I see what you mean. I didn't know that. I guess if I knew that, I had forgotten it. But yeah, that's a really good point.
It might be a little too weird, you know?
Yeah, I think so.
To go into some of the shit girls go through when they're growing up, you know?
It's a good point, too, that he's telling his story, or at least a story that he understands. He probably rightly knows that he doesn't really know what it's like to be a little girl growing up, and it may have been artificial for him to try and tell his daughter's story.
Right, exactly. Yes, that write what you know. You know, and he's this is right. His opus. This is his life. You know, and he does dip into his own life in a lot of his movies, and he does it really well. But that's what he does as an artist and filmmaker. You know,
so many directors do that. How many directors can we name who have surrogates for themselves that they find an actor who can represent them, their own feelings on film, and they make movies with them again and again, even if they're totally unrelated movies. They go back to the same actor because for some reason they connect with this actor on a surrogate level.
I can't wait for two things to happen. I can't wait for everybody to see this movie, and you included, Ryan, and I can't wait for Oscar season to be over because I don't really want to watch what's going to happen to this movie. I don't even want to hear. I don't want to hear anybody
talking
about it.
Off the gauntlet, right?
I don't want to hear any of this hideous shit that's about to happen. I just don't even want to watch this movie, which I think is so special, go through this hideous dog and pony.
There's a movie like that every year, though. It's not as if this is an unusual, unique situation.
I know, but
there's
I
a movie every year that we
I'm
feel emotionally
saying,
attached to that we hate
I can't wait for it
to
be
to
over. I can't wait for it to be over, and I can't wait for it to not be defined anymore by the Oscar year. That's all. You know?
It sucks that it's even in the conversation in a way. I mean, it's good because if it is in the conversation, that'll convince more people to see it. But it's a movie that's so far beyond any award that you could give it that the shit slinging that's going to happen and the needless speculation and the just all the usual Oscar crap is way beneath this movie.
The dog and pony show, the handshaking SAG, you know, it's like...
And the fact that IFC is not renowned for handling Oscar projects very skillfully,
well,
you know, I hate to say it, but they're
not.
It's
not IFC, though. It's Cynthia Schwartz, and they are really good.
Oh, okay.
Cynthia
I didn't
Schwartz.
Know.
That's the thing, is IFC has never had a movie like this that really even had a chance. So that was my first response when I found out that IFC was distributing it, that they don't really have a dog in the Oscar fight, and they're not even going to try. But they've never had a movie like this before.
You know, they're definitely doing that, and they're all very willing to, because they know that a lot of people have worked on this thing for 12 years. And, you know, I was listening to and arguing with a couple of different people on Twitter. I know, how weird, how unusual, me arguing on Twitter. Imagine that.
That never happened.
I know, right? I'm so nice on Twitter. But they were saying how, you know, the movie... You know, they weren't going for Oscars and blah, blah, blah. But here's the thing is, I don't think they're going for Oscars for ego. I think they're going for Oscars to help to validate and reward that hard work that of all those people that spent dedicated 12 years of their lives to this. That's why Patricia Arquette and the actors, that's why they're all coming out and doing so much publicity. They want it to be a success. They want these people to feel as though their 12 years wasn't in vain. And I don't think they should be punished for that. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. I I would never lose respect for them for going for the Oscar, because it does put a stamp on that long and time investment, you know, and that's one thing the Oscars can do. That's one thing they can do that's mm-hmm. positive.
Another thing too that I feel personally is that Richard Linklater is a national treasure who's been undervalued for two decades, and every 4 or 5 years something movie comes along and people think this is going to be the time when he's finally recognized, and it never happens. We all thought it might happen last year or the year before with the end of the Before trilogy, right?
Right,
well, and it didn't happen, and
right,
and so it's like, how, what does it take for this guy to get some appreciation from the industry?
Yeah, but this is on a totally different level. Like, I think with that Before movie, it tried your patience. I mean, especially the last one. Like, I loved these movies, but I know a lot of people didn't, and you had to really be on board with all three to really get that third one. But this movie doesn't have such a requirement. Like, you can just sit down and watch it, and believe me, it's blowing more people away than it is disappointing them. There are just a few people out there, a couple of guys I know who just...
Oh, I'm so sure. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it sounds like the emotional hook is just irresistible. But I will say about the trilogy, the Before trilogy, I was fortunate in that I missed the first two completely when they first came out. I was not even around. I didn't even, wasn't even aware of them. And so I missed the first two movies completely, and I watched them both the night before that I saw the third one. So in essence, I saw the six-hour version of the Before trilogy all edited together because I watched them back-to-back. And that's astonishing to watch it like that, because it's
neat.
Breathtaking to see the jump, but every 10 years.
Wow, cool!
It was really. I think that I would recommend it to anyone to just be able to erase their mind completely and see them all, you know, together as a 6 hour movie.
Yeah, no, I've watched them both many times. I'm in love with them. I actually love all three of them. I'm slightly partial to the first two. The last one is great and everything, but it's so depressing.
Yeah, it is, really. You think, oh, we've stuck with these characters for 5 hours in order to see it end like this.
I know,
that's
they're
the sad
at
thing.
Each other, really?
But it's reality, too.
Yeah.
It's a sad reality.
It's true, but I just love the discovery and the beauty of the first two. They just really...
Right.
I love the movies, all three of them. I'm not going to complain. I think, thank you, Richard Linklater, for bringing these stories. Mm-hmm. You know,
and I think the people who say that those movies try their patience, they really, they may be the guys like Kenneth Turan, who really is just, they just can't really invest that much time in people, in people's everyday lives, in an everyday situation. They need something that's a little more dramatic than the passage of time.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that, yes. And that's why people are a little bit worried about that this whole Oscar thing, is that because, you know, what are like 70-year-old Academy members? He said he did what? Wait, what? What did he do? He did what?
You know, right. No.
Because they're so old. I don't know how they're going to relate to it, but hopefully there are enough people in there that they will, you know.
The interesting thing to me about the Boyhood Oscar push that it's currently getting is it's happening while the film is still in theaters. I'll be curious to see whether it continues after they've made as much money off of it as they possibly can. But I love the idea that they're basically using Oscar in order to drum up business, and that's exactly what they should be doing.
I'm also excited to see if yes, they are, and it's making money, which is lovely, but... if the critics will do to it what they did to 12 Years a Slave, which was, you know, give it the best reviews of the year, the most scores of 100 from the critics, and get almost every critic award you could imagine until you get to the big city critics, the Los Angeles, New York, and the National Society, and then they did not. They snubbed their nose at 12 Years a Slave. So because of the backlash, really, because they were just sick of it and they didn't want to be a foregone conclusion. They wanted
it was
to
no longer the flavor of the moment.
Yeah, I think sometimes, too, what happens with critics, especially the big city critics, is they see these extraordinary movies early in the year, September, August, September, and by December, the fun has worn off. I mean, the fun of being supporting those movies has worn off. And then they get to go to these big splashy premieres of these big Christmas and holiday movies that blow them away for a couple of weeks, and they vote during that period. When they've just been blown away by something.
I think in this case, and with Zero Dark Thirty, I think that there was definitely a backlash to the backlash. Like, they didn't want to be... they didn't want to pick what the Academy, everybody thought the Academy was going to pick. Like, I think that's what was going on. Like, they really seemed to want to distinguish themselves, because if that was true, Ryan, all the other critics wouldn't have picked 12 Years a Slave either. You know, like, they would have gone off, and if there was a movie that got better reviews, you know, you could see it winning. There was something about that.
Yeah, I see your point, but I do think that the big city critics are the ones who weigh in first. We hear from the New York and L.A. critics, and then the other critics seem to have the backlash to the backlash that comes after the big city critics have already weighed in.
There was a little bit of that going on. Yeah, there was. But National Society was the last one to ring in, as they always are. No, I'll never get over that, by the way. And I'm glad to hear a lot of critics that belong to those groups writing me and saying they couldn't believe how it went down, and they were kind of horrified.
Are we talking about Zero Dark Thirty?
12 Years a Slave.
Okay, right, okay.
See, the thing is that the New York film critics will always carry their American Hustle victory as a badge of shame, as far as I'm concerned. It had no impact, ultimately, on the race. 12 Years a Slave still won.
Can we talk about it? And yes, thank you.
What's that?
No, nothing. I'm just saying, if you take American Hustle and you take 12 Years a Slave and you take Gravity, right, and you look at these three movies as being the three that we're heading in. Okay, Inside Llewyn Davis is a great movie. It totally deserved its award. But the other three, it's like, you know, these movies to me are American Hustle is way down the list. I'm sorry, this is not a good movie. But the other two are, you know, good movies with quote-unquote problems. You know, they're movies that a lot of people really love, but a lot of people didn't, you know. So, but I think in the case of these two, I do feel, and I'll never be able to prove it, that the critics didn't judge the movie. They more or less were working off of backlash and buzz rather than, and what felt sexy at the moment, rather than looking at the movies themselves and picking the best one. Although, I can't argue with them picking Inside Llewyn Davis as Best Picture of the Year. I think that was a really good choice for the National Society.
Who did that? Now the National Society of Film Critics. Yeah, bravo to them. Good for them.
Yeah.
That's the thing, though, is I'm looking back at it a year later, and in the moment, it really annoyed the shit out of me when the New York Film Critics picked American Hustle, but now I see it for what it is, and it's what Ryan was talking about. There's this fatigue that sets in, and everybody's been talking about all the same movies for the last 3 months, and then here comes everybody's favorite David O. Russell with The Boner of the Minute, and everybody falls for it, and that's the movie that they pump. But within, you know, 15 minutes of seeing that movie, the sugar buzz wears off, but they've already voted and it's too late. And
right,
that boner. So history will show them as being morons, but it had no impact ultimately on A, the Oscar race, or B, what people think of the movies.
Well,
because that boner does last for a couple of days. It lasts for about a week before the boner finally fades away before you know.
not for me. It was gone before I got back to the car in the parking lot.
It actually did that the races did have an impact on the movie, and 12 Years a Slave did just barely win Best Picture. It was a really tough thing there down to
the We know that it was tight because it tied at the Producers Guild.
But American Hustle and 12 Years a Slave was also really tight at the New York Film Critics, apparently. Remember the weird voting stories, how, like, everybody left? And there was, Armon White there left, and he was a huge champion of American Hustle, and he hated 12 Years a Slave. So what
a
weird year.
He bullied everybody into voting his way so they could all go home.
So I'll come right out and say that he is the guy that hated on Boyhood for all the stupid wrong reasons.
Yeah, and
I wasn't going to mention him, but there you go.
Nonetheless, I will be surprised and interested to see. I know that the critics don't like Oscar stink on their precious darlings, so I will be interested to see how they treat Boyhood after they gave it this wonderful score.
But good point that Craig made earlier is right now it's good to talk it up in as many different ways as possible, especially as awards material, because it encourages people to go see what it's all about, which is going to be a little bit of a tough sell anyway when people realize it is a three-hour movie that is really hard to describe what it's about, except for the fact that we watched somebody grow up for 12 years. It's hard to give a synopsis of this movie, I'm thinking, right?
Yeah, there's no way to sum it up in a sentence why you should go see this movie. It's really
difficult. But the distributor, I'm sure, has the sense that this movie could be one of those small-budget movies that can really break out and do something like, not to compare them in any way, except financially, but my Big Fat Greek Wedding that cost a little nothing and then earns $200 million. They're saying that this is possible, that this movie could take off like that if enough people catch on and glom onto it and feel like that it has become the movie that everybody needs to see. Do you think?
I don't think it would ever reach that level of box office because it's not that easy. That was a pretty feel good sort of really likable kind of movie, whereas this movie is more of a punch you in the stomach and make you think about it for a little while kind of a movie. And that's not what a movie in my mind that's going to make $200 million, but it's
I don't either. I'm just saying that maybe the distributor has hopes for that, but I think I've already written on Twitter and on the site both that I would be surprised if the movie ultimately tops 20 million or 25 million. I would be surprised, but that would be great because that's six times what it cost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know where it's going to go money wise, but yeah. I can say, you know, I have obviously great respect for Kenneth Turan, and I have always loved him as a writer and appreciated his opinion, and I do take it to heart how he feels, because I do think that Boyhood is an extraordinary film, but I don't think of myself as a film critic. And I don't know why he didn't think it was extraordinary, you know, and knowing that he didn't think that does sort of dampen my opinion of it a little bit. And I wish it didn't, but it does a little bit. And I wonder why, you know, I think about it. But to my mind, yeah, it's an extraordinary movie. Extraordinary. I've never seen anything like it. I never seen anything like The Congress either, for that matter. And so I'm loving that there's this kind of experimentation going on with not Ari Folman, but with Richard Linklater, who's an American film director who's doing this kind of experimentation. I love that. You know, I love it that America is still a hotbed of creativity, so much so that the Academy has had to go overseas to find the kind of cliched directors that they like. You know, like, I'm not saying that Alfonso Cuarón and Steve McQueen are cliché. I'm just saying that, like, these foreign directors are making the more traditional films at Oscars, like, while the Americans are
like doing... that French guy.
Are doing all this, or the British guy.
Or the British guy.
Or the other British guy.
His name we won't mention because everyone
the
knows.
The other British guy.
Do you mean Schmom Schmooper? Mr. Dutch Angle?
But I just love it that the Americans are like Paul Thomas Anderson and David Fincher and, all these, you know, Richard Linklater. They're just doing all this cool, groovy stuff, you know, and the Academy doesn't quite know what to do with them. They you know, they want their feel-goody kind of crap, you know. So, again, I'm not saying that it's crap. I'm just saying that the Academy, they like traditional movies. And American directors, the top ones, aren't making those kind of movies anymore. You know, they like the
movies that they're familiar with and comfortable with because they know how to process those movies. I think in other movies that are so different from anything they've seen before, they really can't even. I know people. I'm not even going to say who they are because they're people I love deeply, people I'm close to in my life, who can't understand what's going on in some movies that I like, just because they don't have the reference. They haven't grown up with the references and had to have the background and to experience those kind of movies that most of us can just grasp immediately. But I have people who I really care a lot about in my life who just don't understand what I see in some of the movies that I love because they don't have a frame of reference to process them. And I think a lot of older Academy members, especially the ones who have been in retirement for 15 or 20 or 25 years, which there many of them have been, I think that they really just like to see the movies that they used to make back in the 70s.
Yes, exactly. Or the 40s. I mean, a lot of these Best Picture winners, they could have been... Well, I mean, okay, we have to exclude Ben Affleck from this group. I forgot about him because he's an American who made a very traditional movie that they like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They liked that Argo. Lest we forget. Anyway, but so we're going to have to...
And who directed Michael Clayton? Michael Clayton is the same sort of director. He can make these throwback movies.
Gilroy.
That can replicate the movies that were made in the 70s and 80s that people say, oh, yeah, I remember when they used to make movies like that. So
exactly.
Maybe they do still make them like they used to. And they love those movies.
Right.
And those movies can get a Best Picture nomination because people see something that they grew up with, that they were making when they had a career.
Right. Exactly. That's what the consensus seems to like. Because we remember, people always do that. They say it's just the Academy, but it's really not just the Academy. It's the whole industry. You know, all of these movies were chosen by a consensus. You know, the DGA, the PGA, the WGA. You know, the Golden Globes, the Critics' Choice. Like, by the time it gets to Oscar, the consensus has already been named. So it's not just those old timies in the Academy who are picking these movies. It's a lot of people. It's a whole consensus. It's what people think of as a quote-unquote Oscar movie. Because I think a lot of these, like the Critics' Choice people, for instance, You can't tell me that they really pick what they think is the best film of the year. They pick what they think the Oscars are going to pick because they want to match up to the Oscars.
Obviously, because their BFCA scores don't ever match up with the actual movies that they choose for the top 10. You can look at the BFCA top 15 movies, and maybe only five of them are in their nominees for Best Picture.
And everybody loves a winner, and you know you can never tell if they're picking the winner because everybody loves a winner, or if they're picking the movie they think the Oscars are going to pick, or they're trying to influence the Oscars. You know, it's tough to say. Or if that's really just the movie that everybody liked best. You know,
more than any other critic troop, I think the BFCA is guilty of wanting to say that they were right about the Oscars, that they were able to guess what the Oscars were going to do.
Well, they brag about it.
Yeah.
They brag about it. They liked the matchup. Speaking of the Oscars, I think we've talked enough, and now it's time to move on to part two, where we're going to really try our best to talk about 2009. Thanks for listening to episode 70 of Oscar Podcast with Craig Kennedy, Ryan Adams, and me, Sasha Stone. And you can check out part two on our podcast page, where we talk about the film year 2009 and how it affected the Oscar race when the first woman won Best Picture and Best Director in Oscar history. The bumper music was Do You Realize by The Flaming Lips and Band on the Run by Paul McCartney and The Wings, both from the Boyhood soundtrack. Thanks for listening.
Stuck inside these four walls, sent inside forever, never seeing no